Make your next move with a beautiful website from our sponsor, Squarespace. Head to squarespace.com and enter the offer code GUARDIANBOOKS to get 10% off your first purchase of a website or a domain. Squarespace. Make your next move. Make your next website.
The Guardian.
Hello and welcome to the Books Podcast. This week we welcome the broadcaster and art supremo, Peter Bazalgette, who makes the case for compassion in The Empathy Instinct, and the novelist Sarah Baum. She came to the studio to talk with Richard Lee about her latest novel, A Line Made by Walking. So Richard, what's the story here?
Well, she's a writer we've been following for a little while, really, ever since her first novel, Spill, Simmer, Filter, Wither, was the reader's pick for the Guardian First Book Award in 2015. She's back with a second. This time it's another loner, a woman this time, who's retreated to the country to try and put her life together again after a breakdown of some sort, and is living in her grandma's cottage. She's also looking around herself in the countryside about her and taking pictures of the animals that she finds, often dead on the ground, and sort of struggling to find a way of making connections.
Which brings us to Peter Bazalgette, who argues that empathy is the glue that binds us together. We'll be hearing him discuss with Claire Armitstead why compassion is under attack in the 21st century and how the arts can help us bridge the gaps in our divided world. But let's start with Sarah Baum, who began by reading from the opening of her novel.
Today, in the newspaper, a photograph of tribesmen in the Amazon rainforest. The picture taken from a low-flying aircraft. The men, naked but for painted faces, lobbing spears into the air as high as they can lob them, trying to attack the largest and most horrifying sky beast they've ever encountered, ever imagined. The caption says they are believed to be from the last uncontacted tribe. What a thing, I think, that there are still people out there. And then, almost immediately, I forget. A smudged sky morning, mid-spring, and to mark it, a new dead thing, a robin. Somehow, they always find me, crouching in the cavernous ditches and hurling themselves under the wheels of my Fiesta, toppling from the sky to land at my feet. And because my small world is coming apart in tiny increments, it seems fitting that the creatures should be dying too. They're being killed with me. They're being killed for me. I decide I will take a photograph of this robin. The first in a series, perhaps. A series about how everything is being slowly killed. Only it isn't. The white strata are bunching into clouds. The bunches are competing with each other to imitate animals. A sheep, a platypus, a sheep, a tortoise, a sheep, a sheep, a sheep. The leaves are breaking out, obscuring the white strata, the sky animals, the irregular spaces of cyan between everything. The fields of the daffodil farm, on the other side of the valley, are speckling yellow and yellower as I watch. Why do I feel as if I'm being killed when it's the season of renewal? Cars don't crash when the days are long. Rapists don't prey in the sunshine. And old folk don't catch pneumonia and expire alone in their rocking chairs. Houses don't burn down in spring. But these things aren't true. Walt Disney lied to me. The weather doesn't match my mood, the script never supplies itself, nor is the score composed to instruct my feelings, and there isn't an audience. Most days I make it to dark without anybody seeing me at all, or at least anybody human. I've been here in my grandmother's bungalow a full 3 weeks now, all on my own. Except for the creatures.
You seem to have a bit of a thing for loners. After a debut novel featuring a damaged man who's shut himself off from society, you've returned with this story of a woman whose world is coming apart. How did you get started on this tale of a woman trying to find a way of coping after some kind of breakdown?
Well, it started, it's funny, the loner thing. I think the books are completely different. And it's only now I'm out and talking about it that I realised that there are a lot of similarities. But it actually started as an essay that I wrote when I was doing my master's in creative writing in Dublin. And we had a workshop called Creative Nonfiction, which was about several years ago. So it was quite prescient even then. And I wrote an essay for it. I think the essay was actually called Time Passes in Robins. And it was about, it was even then I was stretching the truth, but it was based around this period of time that I'd spent living in the bungalow of my dead grandmother. It was about 3 years after she died, and it was during the recession at home and no property was selling. And I was living in Dublin City, and again, I mean, very much the scenario is true in that sense, and feeling very lost and disillusioned, finding it hard to pay rent, and ended up spending, I find it hard to remember, I think it was maybe just a summer, but I've now, you know, taken so many details of that actual period of my life and changed them that I can't quite remember what the true version was.
Creative nonfiction, wasn't it? So the creative element was there right from the beginning.
Yes, yeah. And then when I knew it was going to be a novel, it became much more creative.
So some of this is indeed drawn from this period in your own life, is it? That's the kernel of it.
Yes, yeah, and those are the feelings in it more than anything. Mm. Even though the circumstances are this sort of atmospheric bungalow that was on a gentle hill. There wasn't a turbine, but you know the way you sort of Irish countryside. I remember plucking details like seeing the Staffordil farm. We lived close enough to it, or we drove past it for a while or something, and just it came into bud. It became, you know, it was green, and then it became really, really yellow. And I remember thinking, oh, that would be a wonderful thing to look out the window at. And then the same with the turbine. There's a few of them just in random places next to houses.
It's patchwork from life rather than drawn from life, as it were.
Yes.
But the emotional core is from this period of life that you had yourself.
Yeah, certainly.
Was it hard returning to, I mean, what was clearly a difficult period for you?
You see, I always read sad things and write sad things, I think. So it wasn't, you know, painful per se. It was more a sort of lost and disillusioned period than a horrible, painful period. And there were a lot of snippets from it, I suppose, that again, I patchworked together in the same way I patchworked together the countryside. So no, I mean, it wasn't a painful journey.
And this is something that you began working on, at least this kernel, this creative nonfiction essay, began before your first published novel.
First novel, yeah. And then sort of got put aside. And then after the first novel was published, even before it was published, I signed for two books quite early on because I knew... Well, I kind of knew that this book was there and could be a book, but I very much tried to sort of write in my mind what was a traditional novel. So it had characters and it had plot, and they were all sort of, they were coming closer to each other and about to converge. And I had about 30,000 words, and then I just realized, this was after Spill Simmer had been written, this was what was supposed to be my second novel, and I just realized I wasn't really interested. And I was cautious of going back to this because it's equally sort of, you know, sad and plotless. And I felt like it was perhaps a bit too close to the truth, but in the end, it was the only thing that I felt compelled to write.
The text is punctuated with these images, with photographs of these dead animals that your narrator comes across as she explores the countryside around the bungalow. Did you include these to ground this work of fiction, this novel, in reality, or just to blur the lines between Frankie and yourself a little more?
I liked the idea of these images appearing, and I've always been a big fan of W.G. Sebald. He used what he called stray photographs or found photographs. So some of them were sort of slightly crap quality things, pictures he took himself, and then others were photographs, picture postcards or clippings that he found.
But they were only a sort of tangential relation to the text, or a slightly sideways relation to what was going on in the words.
Yes, yeah, and absolutely no caption. And I really love that. And I mean, the pictures appear in the text where the animal is found in the book. But I like the idea that a reader would kind of look at them and go, hey, but this is actually the animal. But, you know, is it a novel? Isn't it a novel?
There's something about the brute facts of a photographic image that, even in the world of Photoshop, calls to mind reality. This happened.
Yeah, no, I definitely wanted that. And was glad when they went in. But at the same time, they weren't really, you know, they're not really, they weren't an art project. They were just a project in which I was collecting images. You know, that I didn't, the book was in no way like the pictures were taken years ago and over the course of years, and just presented themselves gratuitously.
The text is also built out of fragments. It's a few paragraphs here, a page or so there, maybe just one paragraph, and then a break. Was this an attempt to capture the fragments of Frankie's thinking?
Yeah, absolutely. I wrote the first novel very much in notebooks, and it was patched together out of snippets of observations or feelings or moods. And when it came to actually sticking it together into a novel, it was a nightmare. And I remember thinking, I'm never going to write another book like this, because it was constantly like it was like a Jenga, in which every time I pushed a block at the bottom, you know, block from the top sort of shifted in it. And after having tried to do a novel in between, I just realized this novel was written in exactly the same way, just stuck together out of, and this is the way Frankie's mind is working. She's talking to herself essentially, and she's hopping between things and also listening to the radio. And so there's quite a few like songs and films and, you know, other parts of popular culture are coming into her frame of reference.
And she's trying to remember the artworks that are kind of appropriate at some point.
Yes, well, obviously, and the artworks is the main anchor.
Embrace the patchwork.
Yes, yeah, and did exactly the same thing all over again.
Among Frankie's despair, there are also flashes of humour and also of ambition. She says, what I look like will not be left behind, only what I make. Do you share this burden of unrealistic ambition, as she puts it?
less so the older I get, I think. That was one of the big difficulties with rewriting the novel last year, was constantly kind of, I had to really embrace the fact that Frankie isn't supposed to be likable necessarily, you know, that everyone isn't going to like her, that she's very flawed and, you know, occasionally sort of prejudiced and vapid and annoying. But I was kind of thinking, you know, I was slightly ashamed. I was like, oh, that's so mature, you wouldn't say that. And I had to sort of think, no, I'm now in my 30s, and I wouldn't say that now, but, you know, she's a version of my 25-year-old self, and that's and I'm not particularly proud of the 25-year-old me either. But yeah, definitely that burden of unrealistic ambition. And I'm able to write full time now, but I'm constantly stressing out about how best to use time. So there's like the time for making things, because what you make is what, you know, what will define you, what you will leave behind essentially, or what means anything. But then if you don't also sort of feed yourself, you know, books and films and art, then the stuff that you make will not be adequate. You know, it will not be as rich or as full as it can be.
And so, indeed life, people.
Just seeing people or experiences and trying to get the right balance between all of those without losing your mind. I still struggle with that, if that's what ambition is.
She examines the nature in the hedgerows and roadsides around her, but also through clips on YouTube. But she's living alone in this bungalow in the middle of nowhere, but she's always at least potentially reachable. Is it all the more lonely to be on your own in this age of the internet?
Yeah, I mean, there's actually not a lot of there's a little bit of internet, and a few people have talked about it as like a millennial novel, and I've kind of gone, oh, like I'm a little bit too old to be a millennial, and there's very little social media, which is the opposite to our, you know, it's not at all appropriate.
She's
to our
almost
times,
cut
really.
Herself off entirely, hasn't she?
Yes, and gets no emails and feels a bit like she's ceased to exist,
but yet the connection's always there, and if she wants to, she could be instantly in touch with anybody at the push of a button.
Yes. So the being alone has become is something completely different for Frankie, and she's physically alone, but yeah, in contact all the time. And I think that's going to be an interesting kind of condition for our times. You know, will anyone ever be alone anymore in the way that like Agnes Martin in the desert was?
With pictures of only a robin, a rabbit and a rat when she's just starting, she dismisses the project as hardly a series yet. She says, I could hardly call it art. Is that what it takes to be art? A certain substantial size, a certain length, something that can be kind of taken as a whole?
that was always my default mold. And still, because I sort of make things, but I don't really think of them as art. But I went to a
What's
very
the difference between something you've made and some art?
And something, yeah, well, you see, it's like I said about the pictures. To me, they were collecting, you know. They were me wanting to form a little group of dead animal photos and going, hey, there's another one, hey, over the course of years. But in college, Frankie's, her experience of college draws from my own. I think I say somewhere that her approach was always make and do. So it was like, you know, rockets out of fairy liquid bottles. And the college that I went to was very into what they called 4D. So like film and media. And so I was in the sculpture department, but I graduated with no great skills. You know, I'm not great at ceramicist or welding or woodwork. And I have always worked in that way of like using available materials, just childish materials in a way, and sticking them together. And so in my mind, it's always like one thing is on its own just like something a child would make. But in vast numbers, then it has a significance that, I mean, and for example, one picture of a dead rat is just a bit gross and anyone could take it. But, you know, a vast collection of all the wild animals that you could find over the course of years is quite a powerful thing. So yeah, that's still my approach.
In the same way that the novel is constructed out of these small fragments that are strung together to create something larger.
Yeah, yeah, I suppose so. So I apply the same thing to writing without even realizing it.
I mean, the book's very existence is almost a sign of hope. I mean, she's so worried about the idea of being able to produce something or being unable to draw or whatever. But the very fact of these words being there on the page means that she's at least producing something.
Yeah, that's funny. It's the kind of idea that Frankie herself is writing the book, even though, because it's in her head, there's nowhere is Frankie actually writing, you know?
No, she doesn't sit down with a computer or with a pen, does she?
No. It is all in her head. But there's a lot of, she's really trying to deal with the gap between, you know, wanting to be an artist and wanting to make art. And really, she's sort of at a stage where she realizes she's just wanted to be an artist. And that hasn't happened. And now she's left with making things or not making things, and is finding it hard to make things just for the pure joy of being alone with the object. I quote occasionally Franny and Zooey by J.D. Salinger. And Franny is, in a way, I think that's probably in my subconscious where the name of my character came from. She's Frankie, is this young woman who is incredibly disillusioned and having an existential crisis or whatever. But she says at one point, I'm sick of not having the courage to be an absolute nobody. And Frankie is also at that point, you know. She still just wants to be a genius, wants to be an art monster, to take the Jenny Offals term, and has to yet to rediscover just the joy of being a nobody and making stuff for herself.
I mean, is that what the difference between making something and making a piece of art is? It to do with the relations with other people? It's displaying, it's putting it on view and getting other people's reaction.
Yeah, I suppose so. But I mean, God, it's like outsider art, you know. There are so many different definitions. But yeah, and I try to explore. I think she said somewhere that she really wants to be an outsider artist, but it's too late for that. You know, there's no going back now.
Do you share this anxiety about having to produce something, wanting to make something that is of value?
Yes. I mean, I think less so kind of as the years go by. My boyfriend, who's an artist, and he's the wonderful, you know, he's the integrity, I always say, because he is happy to make stuff, and not, he doesn't like the art world or the sort of networking aspects and all of this. He won't sell things. He does not sell. And I have huge admiration for him in a way, because I think I still desperately need that sort of reassurance, the validation. But, you know, he kind of says everything ends up as nothing in the end. You know, everything will end up as dust.
The long view.
Yeah. So, no, I'm still struggling with that.
So what's next for you? Is it more words, or are you going to be making things?
I'm making things, but I've said this a lot over the last few days. I'm like, probably no one's ever going to see it. So, like, don't ask me in a couple of years. But I think it's just really important to, you know, to follow your instinct. I'm determined I will not write a book because, you know, because there might be a market for it or whatever the case may be. If I don't feel compelled to write a book, I'm not writing one. And for the moment, I just feel I've put a lot of words in the world in the last 2 years, and there's already so many words in the world, I might just take a step back and let them rest. See how the second book does.
Squarespace's award-winning templates are the most beautiful way to present your ideas online. Head to squarespace.com and enter the offer code GUARDIANBOOKS to get 10% off your first purchase of a website or a domain. Squarespace. Make your next move. Make your next website.
From quiet fields and rural solitude to bright lights and Big Brother.
Yes, next up is Peter Bazalgette, who will forever be known as the television producer who brought that reality TV show to our screens. He's the outgoing chair of Arts Council England, and he's now written a book which is calling for the arts to be reimagined as a political tool to help create a more civil society.
When he joined Claire Armitstead, she began by asking him, where did the idea for the empathy instinct come from?
You know, it comes from really realising that I'd been a trader in empathy as a TV producer for many years without realising it. And a couple of things happened to me. I was asked to help design a new Holocaust memorial for the government in central London, which is something we're in the middle of. And I met lots of survivors of the camps, people who really came from societies apparently without empathy. And secondly, yes, heading the Arts Council, where we really thought quite hard about why would you put public money into arts? I mean, what are the benefits? And there are lots of benefits like social benefits, educational benefits, economic benefits, but there are intrinsic benefits as well. One of those is a phrase we came up with, empathetic citizens. So the arts is essentially telling human stories that help you put yourself in somebody else's shoes and seeing things from somebody else's point of view. And that is a sort of definition of empathy. And if you think about it, it isn't just arts and culture. It's also broader popular culture. Television, radio, cinema, computer games, a lot of them, all have this quality of telling human stories and helping us see things from somebody else's point of view.
My guess is that when you wrote this or you started writing, you couldn't have imagined exactly how pertinent it would be. I mean, you quote as one of your starting points Barack Obama's statement about the empathy deficit in society. And now we're into a sort of completely unempathetic presidency, as far as we know. Were you aware of something brewing in this direction?
No, but I'm pleased you said that. And I think a lot of people feel, and I hope it is the case, that the book is timely. 2016, in Europe, in America, not to mention a lot of other places, seemed like a very dramatic and traumatic year, and we sort of discovered we were divided, and we had a sort of obvious example of that in the UK, because we had a referendum with a binary question where we said yes or no to something, and we felt a very divided country. And the nature of the practice of politics in 2016 was very ad hominem. The referendum campaign, people were very aggressive on both sides, actually. And now we've got the era not just of the lack of empathy, but we've got the era, apparently, of alternative facts, we now learn.
It's the phrase. The post-truth era.
The post-truth
otherwise
era.
Otherwise known as, yes.
And actually, there is a chapter in the book called The Digital Dystopia, because what that says is the internet has got many advantages, manifest advantages, but it has a downside, and we're only 10 or 15 years into the digital millennium. And we don't fully understand yet the effect it's going to have on us, on human society. So things like cyberbullying and revenge porn and fake news and radicalization of teenagers, these are all things that are happening that couldn't have happened before without the internet. And the actual action of making a communication online textually to somebody else whose face you cannot see, whose voice you cannot hear, where you cannot register the reaction of what you've done. And I quote in the book quite a lot of statistics from The Guardian, because The Guardian did some really interesting analysis of the remarks at the end of articles and the abuse and the sort of people who make those abusive remarks.
That was our Web We Want project, which was one of the pet projects of editor Catherine Viner when she had just started.
And hats off to Catherine Viner, your editor, because that Web We Want project, and I've quoted some of the statistics in the book, is absolutely crystallises this issue of electronic, what you might call technical communication in the age of the internet, where you don't see who you're communicating with. It is profoundly unempathetic.
Let's just scroll back. And your premises, you used three historical monstrosities as, in a way, part of your evidence base, your historical evidence base. You've got Armenia, the massacre of the Armenians in the early 20th century, the Holocaust, and then the Rwandan genocide a bit later. Why did you go back to those three particular episodes? And what you talk about there is the dissemination of hate speak and of contempt and of disgust, which seem to be the two triggers of unempathetic behaviour.
My starting point was being involved in this government project to build a new Holocaust memorial and talking to the survivors of the camps of mid-20th century Germany. And I've called the chapter Societies Without Empathy because it's snappier than Societies Apparently Without Empathy. But what's really intriguing, and right at the beginning, I quote a primatologist called Franz de Waal, who wrote a book called The Age of Empathy. And he studied empathy amongst primates, and they've got about 80% of human empathy equipment. And what he says is, we've evolved to be loyal to those in our own tribe, in our own family, in our own group or circle, and hostile to those outside. That's a sort of really quite visceral, almost primeval thing, phenomenon. And so he says empathy makes you loyal to people within your group, within your tribe, and hostile to people outside your tribe. So in a sense, empathy could in that sense be said to be an origin of racism. And it's only when you like the arts and culture, that's their role, is to get you to see a point of view of somebody outside your circle, outside your tribe. That's the civilizing influence of arts and culture and other influences as well. So I took those three societies because there were massive genocides in all three countries. A minority population was demonized. There had been previous attacks on that, those minority population. And in all cases, they didn't have full civil rights and had been forced into commerce. And then people were jealous at how wealthy some of them were. And this is all this is the case for the Armenians. It's the case for the Jews in Germany. And it's the case for the Tutsis in Rwanda. And then I contrasted it with two or three people who, at the risk or even the loss of their life, hid people. So they were able to deploy the empathy instinct in that elevated way beyond their tribe to help people that they wouldn't naturally sympathize with in their group. And that is human beings at their very best, not their very worst.
And is the suggestion that those individuals have something better in their genes or in their nurture than the mass of society?
There's been some quite good research done into people in Poland and Germany who helped the Jews. It was done by a couple of academics called Olina. And they found that those people had almost certainly been raised in very compassionate, embracing families and had strong moral leads from their parents. And here you've got a combination of things, because empathy on its own is not enough. It needs to be combined with a sense of ethics, reciprocity and fairness. You know, just feeling nice about somebody doesn't lead you to a compassionate action. The compassionate action that flows from it, that goes beyond empathy, is important. And that takes me to somebody I quote in one of the chapters, Professor Simon Baron Cohen at Cambridge, who's done all the work on people who are autistic, who don't have the full empathy package, and what regions of the brain function and malfunction in those circumstances. And he's written a couple of very good books on this. But he talks about his mother, and indeed good mothers, in particular mothers, but parents, giving children their internal pot of gold. And I quote in one of the chapters a wonderful American neuroscientist called James Fallon. And he discovered that he had all the, in his brain mapping, when he had an MRI scan, he had all the makeup of a psychopath. He was actually a professional scientist. And he compared himself to actual psychopaths, and they found he had all more markers for it than anyone else. And he said every time he went home, he thanked his elderly mother for bringing him up with love and compassion, because he believes that's what meant that he wasn't a psychopath as an adult, although he'd been quite a troubled teenager. And that was the internal pot of gold that Simon Baron Cohen refers to.
So can I just bring you to the science of this? Are you saying that it is possible to look at an image of the brain and see whether somebody has empathy or doesn't have it?
So our social abilities, of which empathy are a part, are a function of lots of different regions of the brain. The MRI scanner, which is now, in effect, 20 years old, doesn't just x-ray your knee when you've broken it. It can show blood flows in the brain, and it's allowing scientists, neuroscientists now, to map the human brain. And we're, I don't know whether we're halfway through, but we're in that process now. And so Simon Baron Cohen in Cambridge, whom I mentioned, has now identified at least 10 regions of the brain that do different things. So the amygdala is one part of the brain that enables you to look at somebody's face and see when they're happy or unhappy or startled. By the way, that's somebody with Asperger's might not be able to do that. They're actually very compassionate people, but they haven't got that bit of the equipment. There are other parts of the brain. I mentioned mirror neurons, which are probably in a human brain. They're certainly in monkeys' brains, that enable you to imagine the situation somebody else is in. So it was done with monkeys eating grapes. And when a monkey saw another monkey eating a grape, the same part of their brain lighted up as if they were eating a grape themselves. And that goes back to Adam Smith, the philosopher and economist, who asked in the 18th century, why do we feel nervous when we see somebody on a tightrope? You're not on the tightrope. Why would you feel nervous? And you don't know them even. You're worried you're going to lose a relative or a friend. And these are all the incredibly intricate functions of different parts of the brain, and they interrelate. And we're halfway through mapping them, and we'll know a lot more in another 20 years. But it does mean that, yes, you can now, for instance, do a brain scan of somebody who is a psychopathic murderer, and you can see some of the bits that don't function. Similarly, you can do a scan of somebody's brain who clearly has difficulty in understanding when somebody else is sad, happy, or whatever, and you'll find a bit that's underperforming or not functioning. So it is a really, really interesting thing, and I think it means that we now understand more about ourselves and why we do and don't get on.
But this isn't purely a science book. It has elements of lots of different things, and at the heart of it is a manifesto for an empathetic future, and which has 10 points on it, and it covers medicine, it covers education, it covers culture. And I'm very interested in the culture bit of it, particularly since this is a books podcast. And you mentioned particularly landmark works of literature such as Harriet Beecher Stowe's Uncle Tom's Cabin or To Kill a Mockingbird, which actually you say have shifted whole society's way of thinking about things towards being more empathetic.
So to take Uncle Tom's Cabin, a name, by the way, of a book that isn't liked by people today for obvious reasons, because Uncle Tom has been used as a racist term, but was the name of the book historically. It is a fact that Uncle Tom's Cabin was the best-selling book in 19th century America after the Bible. And it was also incredibly influential in American history because it persuaded a lot of white people that black people were flesh and blood, like themselves, human beings, when they had never, during the times of slavery, regarded them that way. And it is thought that Uncle Tom's Cabin was extremely influential in allowing Abraham Lincoln to pursue his Civil War, which, if you believe some historians, was a war to end slavery. Others say it has economic factors, but let's take that as at least a partial reason for it. So it was very, very influential. And To Kill a Mockingbird, incredibly influential in the 20th century. I was watching 8 days a week, a documentary about the Beatles touring in America, which came out just before Christmas. Amazing sequence where Paul McCartney decides the Beatles are not going to play to a segregated audience in the stadia of the Deep South, which were all segregated. And so they had them mixed, and they interviewed a black woman historian who said it was the first time she'd been in a public place sitting next to white people, and she remembered it with crystal clarity. And that's the America The Killer Mockingbird was launched into. And yes, these books are extraordinary in getting you to understand somebody else's point of view, somebody else's predicament. And that's the role of arts and culture. And we're going full circle here, because when I became chair of the Arts Council 4 years ago, I said to all my colleagues, can we come up with all the reasons why we'd put public money into arts and culture? Because the government, for perfectly agreed reasons, any party in power in 2010 would have been cutting government expenditure, but they were cutting arts investment along with all the other government expenditure. We had to come up with the best case for the arts. And part of it was the intrinsic support for the arts, and part of that was empathy, and it's palpable. But do you know something? It's something we take for granted. Because if you were at a play tonight in the theatre, or if you were watching a television drama, do you actually ever stop to say to yourself, I'm emotionally engaged, I'm moved, I'm sympathetic, I want to know what happens, and yet I don't know this person? This person doesn't even exist. They're fictional. Now, there is something, if you stop to think about that, that's a sort of wonderful gift we have, isn't it? And that's the empathy instinct.
And you mentioned, since I had a bit of a dig at Big Brother at the beginning, I thought I ought to say that you make the point that a couple of the winners have demonstrated our capacity for empathy. For example, Pete, who had Tourette's syndrome.
So look, I don't make great claims for Big Brother. It's some years since I produced it, and it was a commercial television programme. And yes, it was made to have advertisements around it and make money. So I'm not trying to make out that television programme was a moral crusade. I absolutely am not. It was a piece of entertainment. However, yes, what came out of it was quite surprising. I particularly remember Pete, who had Tourette's syndrome, and Nadia, who was transsexual. And when they first went in, they were demonised by the tabloid newspapers. And they were demonised on the basis of a stereotype. And what happened during the series was that the enormous warmth and charm of their personalities came through. And viewers of Big Brother in the UK like authenticity. They're looking for good people. I don't know how it works today because I'm not involved in it anymore. But in those days, those are the people they voted to win. It's quite different in America, by the way. In America, the person who cheats the most wins because they think it's a competition you have
Fancy
to win.
Fancy that. Where yes. have I heard that before?
Yeah, quite so. But yes, that was the case. So it was a very nice and surprising outcome of the programme.
But you could say that those people, just because of us having privileged access to them, they become part of our tribe, the tribe of empathy. Out with are all the other transsexuals and Tourette's people who we don't sympathise with because we haven't seen them. So they become part of the special case.
And therefore,
they just become part of our tribe. Therefore, we're not expanding the boundaries. You know, the old thing about, I have many of my best friends are black, right, or whatever people say.
I wouldn't agree with that, because if you have seen the real person that lies beneath, you know, the exterior, if you like, if I can put it that way, and if you've discovered that that person has the same hopes, fears, dreams as anyone else, then you would be, I think, immensely less inclined to stereotype another transsexual person when you met them. And I think you'd be inclined to be far more sympathetic to their predicament. So I don't think that's the case. I think it does extend our circle or extend us out of our immediate tribe.
Now, what's interesting about this in the end for me, this book, is that there have been books about empathy. You've mentioned a few of them. There is a history of books about empathy. But in a way, you're reaching past empathy because, as you say, empathy is a limited response. It's the post-empathy world, isn't it?
Yeah.
The capacity of the arts to expand empathy beyond our own interests.
So the empathy instinct is the starting point. We know more about it because neuroscience is now mapping the brain and explaining it. And the question is, does it lead to compassionate action? And not at any cost. You know, if you believe in philanthropy, if you give away all your money, you starve. Is that sensible? No. So it has to be empathy that leads to compassionate action that is rational and that has also with it a sense of ethics and a sense of reciprocity and fairness. All of those things are what make human societies tick or fail to tick.
That was Peter Bazalgette speaking with Claire, and his book The Empathy Instinct is published by John Murray. Sarah Baum's A Line Made by Walking is published by William Heinemann. They're both out now.
Next week, we welcome a familiar face with The Guardian's Zan Brooks, a film critic of much repute, who's coming in to talk about his debut novel, The Clocks in This House All Tell Different Times.
But here, the clocks in this studio are telling us it's all the same time. It's end of podcast time. But before you go, if you like this podcast, why not try some of the others that we make here at The Guardian? This month, we're featuring Token. It's a weekly podcast about marginalised identities in which presenters Leah and Freddie bring fresh light to old trips. To listen, just go to theguardian.com/podcasts.
Which is where you'll find us too. Just search for Guardian Books Podcast. You can find us on theguardian.com, on iTunes, on SoundCloud, or by swiping, tapping, or manipulating in any manner you choose your smartphone. Just open up your favourite podcast app. You can join the conversation too, either by commenting on the Guardian website or at Guardian Books on Twitter. But for now, from me, Richard Lee.
And me, Sian Kane.
And our producer, Susanna Tresillian. Goodbye and thanks for listening.
Bye.
For more great podcasts from The Guardian, just go to theguardian.com/podcasts.